we're scoring about 5% in our test of what's the universe made of.
The Bible describes the real world as we know it. It has the ring of truth.
What kind of country is it that we live in when you can't tell a child why his father was killed because you didn't want him to grow up hating white people?
Does the human race deserve to continue?
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Justine Toe. Now, just a heads up, this is a pretty heavy episode. And maybe that's appropriate because I was at a funeral this morning for my husband's grandmother, Odette. Now, I didn't know her that well. I didn't think that I would get as upset as I did. But as the tributes were read and as the photos were shown of her, I realised that in a sense I did know her because I recognised the influence that she'd had on her family and the way that she'd shaped people's lives. I could see that my sister-in-law actually looks a lot like Odette. I could see that the devotion my mother-in-law shows to my children, her grandkids, is the exact same devotion that Odette showed to her grandkids. And the tragedy of it all just hit me, as it does every time that I go to a funeral. Each person is unique and unrepeatable, with their own personality, their own quirky mix of habits and experiences. And the mark they leave on other people's lives is profound. I think what I felt today was the truth that when someone dies, their loss undoes all of us. Nancy Guthrie had to live through what some have said is the worst of all experiences of death, the loss of a child. And she had to go through it twice. When I first came across her story, I couldn't even comprehend it. She's experienced so much loss. But in the depths of her own grief, she's also learned how to grieve well, how to lean into that mess of emotions that is grief and to find a place for it as life moves forward. And she's also found a way to help others who are facing similar situations. She and her husband David host weekend retreats for couples who've lost a child. And she's quick to point out that she's not a grief counsellor, but she's really been able to draw from her own experience to support other people. And this is where we started our conversation with Nancy, her own experience of loss.
My husband David and I have a son, Matt, who will turn 28 while I'm here in Sydney this week. When our son was 8, I gave birth to a daughter named Hope. And Hope was born with a rare metabolic disorder called Zellweger syndrome. We had never heard of that. And what it meant was that she was missing a tiny subcellular particle that you and I have in every cell of our bodies. And that little particle, a little enzyme, has a particular job in our cells, and that is to remove the toxin of long-chain fatty acids. So we found out on her second day of life that her life would be very short, very difficult, that there was no treatment, no cure, that this syndrome had already done a lot of damage to all of her major organs, especially her liver and her kidneys and her brain. So that, as you can imagine, was devastating news. You know, I was so looking forward to having a daughter who would grow up with us and grow old with us. And so the reality of Hope's life, Hope couldn't see or hear or respond. But the other really significant aspect of her life was her life was meaningful. Life has value just by being made in the image of God, as all humans are. Life has value. It's not based on what a person can accomplish or contribute. It's not measured by the length of that life, not even the quality of that life. So her life had significance and meaning. It changed our lives in more ways than I could begin to recount to you.
You've already alluded to you have a belief in God.
Yes.
I guess the most obvious question is, how can this happen to a child and to my child?
Well, I think you're asking the question that every person who goes through incredible loss asks, which is why. I think, you know, many people look for an answer to that question. For some people, that's a very philosophical question, you know, in terms of the universe and how it works and how things happen in the world. For other people, I think that question, why, is very circumstantial. they want to believe that it serves some greater purpose, the losses of this life. And so they look around at their circumstances and they're looking for something that has come about because of the loss that might somehow outweigh it or somehow balance it out or somehow bring some sense to it. I think I asked that question, why too? But my search was more, I was looking for a scriptural answer. You know, I had spent a lot of time in my life studying the Bible, but honestly, nothing pushed me deeper into trying to understand what the Bible is about than this. Because honestly, you know, as much as I had studied the Bible, when I went back to the Bible in the midst of this and following Hope's death, Hope was with us for 199 days and then she was gone and I had lots of questions, you know. There were things I thought I understood about God that this kind of brought to the surface. Maybe I didn't understand as much as I thought I did. But as I went to the Bible trying to understand this, I actually did find some answers. One answer I found was at the very beginning of the Bible. And the Bible story begins with Adam and Eve, and then they're in the garden, and Adam and Eve, instead of obey God, rebel against him. And a curse is pronounced on the serpent who tempted them. And the ground, the very ground that Adam and Eve were meant to be taking care of. And the impact of this curse, it's stated, is going to impact them. It's going to overflow into them and their lives. God says to Eve that she's going to have pain in childbirth. Now, I think lots of people have thought about that mainly in terms of labor pains, labor and delivery.
And they are profound.
And they are profound. But that's about much more than that. You know, this is talking about the pain of infertility and miscarriage and birth defects. It's the pain of raising a child in a world that has become so broken by sin. So when I looked at the Bible through that lens, asking that question, why, I found there in Genesis 3 this understanding that the impact of sin on our world, on the created order, has meant that what was once so pristine and beautiful because of the impact of sin became broken, and that the curse has infiltrated all of creation, and I would say even my genetic code, so that my husband and I are both carriers of this recessive gene trait. That means whenever we have a child, that child would have a 25% chance of having the fatal syndrome. And so when people ask me, why do you think you've had two children with a fatal syndrome? My answer is because I live in a world that is broken to the core by the impact of sin. I remember around the time we had Hope, being around someone who was talking about these two aspects of God, his sovereignty, meaning he's in control, and then his love. And he made the point, you don't want it to just be one or the other. You know, I think there are many people in this world who talk about God in terms of God is love, but they don't want to speak about him as sovereign, or the opposite. Like, he's in charge, but I don't know that he loves us. And so I found in the midst of this circumstances, I needed to know what I grabbed hold of in the storm. This was like a storm in my life. And you know how there's a storm with winds, people like grab hold of something solid and secure. And I grab hold of those two solid realities that I believe are true about God, which is that he is sovereign, he's in control, and that he loves me. You know, if he's in control, but he doesn't love me, I don't know that he's going to use his control for good in my life. And if he just loves me, but he's not in control, how can he accomplish any kind of loving purposes? But as I grabbed hold of both of those, for me, that meant I believe this has not happened to me outside of God's control, but that it's actually somehow going to accomplish his loving purposes for my life and for my family.
So Hope was with you for 199 days. then there's the whole process of grief.
Yeah. You know, I think I thought I was one of those people. It's like, I know she's going to die, so somehow I'm going to get ahead of the curve and it won't be as hard for me when she does die because it won't be a surprise. And I was so kidding myself because it just didn't work that way at all. You know, I talked to you about how in many ways I felt so enriched by Hope's life, and I did. And initially when she died, I felt that sense, but that went away very quickly. So that pretty soon I just felt empty and confused and just so sad, so disappointed. You know, people often ask me, did you get angry? My most profound emotion wasn't anger. It was disappointment. I was so disappointed that she wasn't there with me, you know.
Yeah.
And not only disappointed in her life and death and then the reality of her not being with us, but the other thing was, you know, David and I had to make a difficult decision about whether or not we would have more children. And so we decided the wisest thing to do would be to take surgical steps to prevent another pregnancy. And so we did that. So there was also the grief of that loss of potential, you know, and reckoning with the reality that our son would grow up as an only child.
But then what happened?
What happened was a really big surprise. I discovered about a year and a half after Hope died that I was pregnant.
Gosh.
And honestly, I was terrified. But at the same time, I drove up to my husband's office and we're sitting there shaking our heads. And, wow. Wow. Didn't expect this, you know. But there were two possibilities. I mean, there was one distinct possibility that we were going to have another healthy child to raise and enjoy, that we thought we had eliminated that possibility. So that was a stunning possibility to consider. But then the other one was that we might have to go through this again. And to me that day, I just remember feeling like, you know, I feel like the sun's just beginning to come out again in my life. Like, I don't cry every time I drive across town in the car by myself. And I just sense like maybe it felt like there were gray clouds gathering in the distant horizon that were getting ready to sweep into my life again. And so I was just, wow. I just remember saying to God, do you mean you might ask me to do this again?
And he did.
He did, yeah. We went through prenatal testing and discovered that the child I was carrying was a son this time, our son named Gabriel, and he too was born with Zellweger syndrome, and he was with us a similar amount of time. He was with us 183 days. Mm. And, you know, anybody who's listening, who's been through the loss of someone in your family, you know what it's like, that, you know, you've got the hubbub of their life or their illness or the anticipation of death, and then death itself, and then a funeral, and then it gets really quiet. It gets really quiet. And so there we were once again, back to a family of three.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. One of the hardest things about grief and loss is that life actually does go on. There's living to be done. Nancy had a living husband and a son, and it couldn't have been easy at all to be a wife and mother and deal with the loss of two children. Here's Nancy on what it was like for her family.
Just the deep hurt when you were in so much pain. It can be so easy to take that out on the person closest to you. It can be so easy to expect that this person who is close to you should be able to fix it and can't. And just, you know, two people in misery in a house can be really miserable together. But I feel grateful that for me and David, it gave us the opportunity to give each other a lot of grace. Gave us the opportunity to ask a lot of questions together and, you know, search together for some answers. And in the years since, it's given us the opportunity to have this joint ministry in the lives of people going through the worst thing that they could ever imagine, which is the death of their child. And I mean, David and I, we head out to these weekend retreats we've do for couples who've lost children. And people around us, they're just like, you're going to do what? Like, you're going to go out to the country in this big lodge with 11 other couples who are in so much pain and spend the weekend together? I mean, they just think it sounds like the craziest, most miserable thing that you can ever imagine. We just held our 32nd retreat the weekend before last, and it's hard because there is, like, we open the door and people with so much pain walk in the door, pain that we don't have tools to fix necessarily. But our experience has been over these now 32 weekends with almost 700 grieving parents,
wow,
that something very special happens. We ask the Lord to come and do a work of healing. We spend the weekend talking about the very hard things grieving parents face, you know, things like, what are you going to do with their bedroom and their belongings? And what are you going to do on their birthday? How about their death day? How are you going to deal with all the people around you who've said things that deeply hurt you, or the people who disappeared that you thought were going to be there for you? So we talk about very practical things. But then we talk about these issues of, you know, where was God in this? What's it going to look like to trust God with this? And then our desire is that somehow we give them a sense that as much pain as they're in now, that they don't have to be in that much pain forever, that they actually could begin to experience joy again and experience a measure of healing in their lives, so that while this will always be a significant aspect, even a broken place inside them, that it doesn't have to dominate their lives and their marriages forever.
Is that what you would say is true for you, that the grief doesn't define you?
I would say it does not define me. Yeah.
Because I can imagine in those early days, you feel swallowed up by it. I mean, I fear it myself. Since I've had children, I feel like if one of them was to die, that I would just be in a black hole for I don't know how long, maybe all time.
Yeah. Well, and that is what happens to some people who lose a child. One thing about dealing with grief in the loss of a child, and I'll just speak as a mom, because I think this is particular to moms, is when you've lost a child, you feel like it's kind of your job to make sure nobody forgets your child. And you miss your child so much. You have this desperate longing to feel close to them. And so continuing to grieve as much as you have, in a sense, makes you feel like you're accomplishing those things. Like you don't want anybody else to forget. And if you, it begins to be the thing you don't think about the first thing in the morning and throughout all the day, that begins to feel like I'm falling down on the job of keeping the memory alive. And if I begin to forget, maybe other people will forget. And then there is a sense, almost a sweetness, that my deep sadness and thinking about my child is what keeps me feeling close to my child. And you almost don't want that to diminish.
Oh, wow. So that's a double bind, isn't it?
Exactly. You're hitting it exactly. Mm. And so what I experienced as a grieving mom, and I think other moms do too, is like you come to the place where you have to just like make a decision about whether or not this grief is going to continue to define you, to be dominant, if you're going to keep giving it a lot of power in your life. Or if you're going to be able to find a place for it in your life, but have it not be so dominating in your life. And for a mom, that is a really hard choice to make. It can feel like a betrayal to your child, like I'm choosing to let you go some. And in some ways it is. But for me, and the way we encourage parents who come to our retreats, especially if you've got other children.
No, that's right. You have to be there for them as
they
well.
They need a mom and a dad who are still choosing to live. They need a mom and dad who are willing at some point to turn away from giving all of their energy and emotion to a child who's not here and can't benefit from it, and instead turn toward their living children, their living spouse, their living family, life itself.
Has Matt read your books, particularly those reflecting on...
Yes, yeah? He has. He has. I remember one of the books, I wrote a book called, with my husband, David, called When Your Family's Lost a Loved One. And in that one, it's been a while now, but I remember kind of fessing up to some feelings of guilt about some of the ways that maybe Matt has had to pay some of the cost for some of my grief. Some of the, you know, pretty early on, I wrote my first book, a book called Holding On to Hope, while I was pregnant with our son Gabriel, and it was published on what would have been his first birthday. So pretty quickly, I was turning around and talking about them a lot, and sometimes I have felt like it can't have always been really fun for our son Matt to have a mom who was out talking about these other two kids who weren't here. So I gave him the manuscript, and I marked all the places where I talked about him, and I just said, first of all, I'm asking your permission. If there's ever written anything about you in here that you don't want, I will change it or not include it, right? And, you know, and he was getting older at that point, you know, older in his teens when I wrote that When Your Family's Lost a Loved One book. And I remember I'd gone to the grocery store and I came back in and he was sitting on the couch and he said, "So, Mom, I read your book." I said, "Okay." And I said, "Well, what do you think?" And he said, "Here's what I think. I think this book is going to help even more than any of the other books you've written."
Right.
And I can't have imagined, you know, that's pretty sweet, you know. And he's not an upfront talker like my husband David and I are. He's more behind the scenes guys, but I think he feels a part of what we do. I think he's proud of his mom. And I just feel really grateful he's not resentful toward his mom. I'm really grateful for him.
You know, people have been saying to me, "How are you?" Which is a total standard American greeting. And I think they meant well. They really wanted to know how I was. But there's no way to answer that question. You can't say what you're thinking in your head, which is, "Well, my husband just died. How am I?" Rather than say, "How are you?" to me or to someone who's grieving or facing hardship, say, "How are you today?" It's that one little word, but it changes it, because what it communicates is, "I know you're struggling to get through the day."
That was Sheryl Sandberg, the COO of Facebook and co-author of Option B, a book about handling tragedy. She wrote it with Adam Grant after her husband passed away suddenly a few years ago. It's something that's stuck with me as I've encountered people, friends, family, even strangers, who've lost a loved one or are really going through any sort of tragedy. I try not to ask them, "How are you?" Nancy's latest book is all about how to support people going through incredibly difficult times. It's called What Grieving People Wish You Knew, about what really helps and what really hurts. Like Sheryl Sandberg, she's not a fan of "How are you?" but prefers "How's your grief today?" It acknowledges that the grief is still there and that it's okay that it's still there. Her book draws on her experience, as well as surveys and conversations and stories from others who've experienced loss. And this is her guiding principle for how to be there for people who are grieving.
Speak up, show up. I think oftentimes we know someone who's had a loss and we think, okay, maybe I'm going to say something, but we kind of chicken out. We are so afraid of saying the wrong thing that we say nothing. Or maybe we see that person in a setting and they look happy and we think, they look like they're having a bad day, and so I don't want to bring it up and make them sad.
Mm.
And so what we have to understand is that grief for a person for a long time, not just a couple of weeks, for a long time. I think of grief as being kind of like, you know, like with your iPhone, if you don't go through every once in a while and close all those windows, there's a bunch of programs that are running in the background and you don't even realize it. I think it's kind of like that with grief. The program of grief is running in the background and maybe you don't see it on the surface, but it's running back there. And so when you speak to them about the person they love who died, and they maybe begin to shed some tears and you think, "Oh no, I've done the wrong thing. I shouldn't have brought it up." No, that's not true. Actually, the program is running You didn't make them sad. They were already sad.
Mm.
And you just gave them the opportunity to release some of that sadness through words or tears as you talk to them. And that's actually a great gift.
But we really want to shut it down, right? Like the worst thing you could do is like, oh, don't make them upset. That'll be the worst, right?
But that's just not the case. When you lose someone you love, you have so many tears inside that need to come out. And here's this one thing that so dominates your thoughts that you want to talk about that seemingly nobody wants to talk to
about. So there's like secondary loneliness,
it's
right?
Like a huge relief.
Yeah, wow.
That somebody is willing to bring it up. And in the survey I did of people, what they want, there's a couple of things in particular they want people to say to them. The first one is they want to hear that person's name. If you think about it, oftentimes we talk about losses in very vague terms, or maybe we even say your son or your daughter. Like we made all of these ornaments with Hope's picture. We took a picture of her during life. She was with us at Christmas, and we stuffed her down in this stocking. Sounds cruel, doesn't it? It wasn't. She fit just fine, and it said Hope on it. And we made like 500 Christmas ornaments, you know. So like when somebody comes up to me and they say, around the Christmas season, and they say, oh, we put Hope's ornament on our tree. Or they say, you know, I remember that Christmas with Hope, you know, or something like that. And they use her name. That's a great joy. If you think about it, if it's somebody you love and you said their name 10 or 20 times a day, and then nobody wants to say their name out of awkwardness.
Yeah.
It's a great gift to say their name. The other thing they really want to hear is they want to hear stories about that person. They want to hear specifics. We tend to get general. We say, oh, you know, Joey was such a great guy, you know. Or, you know, Sarah, she had so many friends. Everybody was her friend. So we can be very general. But to say, I remember that time when Joe did that, you know, when he showed up at my door with whatever, you know, those very specific. Or I remember that day when I was so low and Sarah came and she said, what's going on with you? So to hear the difference, you know, like there's a big difference between that just very general thing and that very specific memory that like gives a gift to that grieving person. It gives a little piece of them back for that moment and that day, especially when it's a memory they didn't experience with that person. I think we oftentimes can assume about people, you know, they just want to be alone. I need to give them their privacy. Well, to a certain degree, but also, I tell you what, you remember the people who show up at the lowest time of your life, whether it's showing up at your house or showing up at the visitation or showing up at the graveside, showing up in the months that follow, not expecting that you're over it quickly, but just keep showing up, willing to listen, maybe not talking so much, but listening. You remember the people who showed up. And this is not something I understood before. I kind of thought, well, at a funeral or at a gravesite, I just thought, well, there's so many people who show up. It won't really matter if I do because they won't know whether or not I'm there. And I'm telling you, you know. You remember who shows up. You remember who's willing to stop the busyness of their life to enter into your sorrow with you on that day. And so it means a lot. So say something instead of avoiding the topic, and show up instead of staying away. I remember walking away from Hope's grave, though, my husband David and I, and David said to me, you know, I think we thought our faith would make this hurt less. And it really doesn't. Faith, it informs loss. It helped us to believe that there would be healing in the midst of loss. But faith doesn't make loss hurt less by any means. So I would say what faith did, probably the most significant thing, was it instilled in me a sense that this loss wasn't random or meaningless. And it filled me with a confidence that this life is not all there is. I remember walking out onto the back patio a few weeks after Hope died and looking up into the sky. And I just said to God, I know Hope is with you, and I'm really grateful to know that. But it just feels so very far away from me. And I tell you what, 19 years out, I am profoundly grateful that I fully anticipate that when I leave this life and I enter into the presence of Christ, that I will see her again and I will see Gabe again. And so I am profoundly grateful that this life is not all there is, but it is important to know how that doesn't fix everything about grief. That there's still a profound sadness of that separation until that day comes.
From the Center for Public Christianity, you've been listening to Life and Faith with Justine Toe. If you know someone who you think will benefit from this conversation with Nancy Guthrie, maybe they've experienced loss or they know someone who's experienced loss recently, please share it with them. You can find it on our website, publicchristianity.org, or on your podcast app. Just type Life and Faith in the search box to find us. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please leave us a rating or a review. It helps us know what you think of the show and helps other people to find it as well. Next week,
I think around 6,000 kilograms of waste goes into landfill every single week.
Wow.
Within Australia. It's just become part of the culture. It's part of the norm. We want to look fresh and we want to look the best and we want to be unique. And chasing after that has really resulted in us moving through our clothes at such a rapid rate without even really thinking about it.
Mm.
And so that's what the idea that we're trying to introduce is this idea of conscious fashion.